Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today's Monday. It's August 2nd, and it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We begin today with none other than White Plains Citizen Net reporter, publisher, editor John Bailey. He'll be on from 10 to 10:30. Michael Edelman, Esquire, the national political analyst and pundit. He'll be on from 10:30 to 11. Then Ron Matten, the Yonkers City Council President, Republican candidate, from 11 to 11:30. And then I'll conclude the last half hour with you from 11:30 to 12. So there are a lot of things happening, particularly health concerns revolve about the resurgence of COVID-19 cases fueled by the Delta mutation and the mention of an even more virulent strain labeled Lambda. So the number of people infected has risen exponentially. We learned the ramifications of this exponential increase and whether the public being informed is bringing about a greater number of people seeking vaccination or not. So has COVID-19 become so politicized that the population is engrossed in the politics of the issue rather than their health and well-being? Well, the U.S. reported over 100,000 new daily COVID-19 cases for the first time since February 6th on Friday. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So we'll have to see where that goes. I see Mr. Bailey is on the line. Good morning, Mr. Bailey. How are you, sir?
Good morning from White Plains, New York, USA.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you on today. This is a somber moment. First of all, good morning. But it's a somber moment because we're going through a resurgence that is so vile, and it is just, it seems to overwhelm people. And I wonder, is the message that we're sending from the CDC or from the state on the state level, are people getting the whole issue, or have we politicized the whole COVID-19 issue? It's either Republican or Democrat or however you want to redefine that imagery. What's going on? Why aren't we getting more people vaccinated? What's the message?
Well,
why is the message not getting out there?
That's a good question. We are, well, number one, right down here locally, as in Westchester County, we're not vaccinating enough people.
No.
We just aren't. We are really behind. We used to vaccinate 15,000 a week in Westchester County back in when we first got the vaccine, but now we're only vaccinating about 6,000, 7,000 a week. That's too little amount of vaccinations. Now, whether there are not enough statistics being put out on this, I mean, we don't know, for example, how many people have eschewed their second shots, okay, and they just decided not to get them because they think they're okay. We don't know if people are just not going out and getting their first shots. And the vaccine tracker that the Governor Cuomo's administration puts out is the only way to learn about this and look at it from week to week. And I mean, the fact that the county isn't even talking about this and telling us how little they're vaccinating, but pushing for vaccinations, is very indicative of what appears to be leading to this real comeback. Because right now, we may as well have not stopped the virus, because we are right back in where we were in late April. On April 24th, we tested 10,000 people, and we found about 150 positive, and that was a 1.5% infection rate. But in the last 7 days, we've gotten to the point as high as 156, 100, you know, positives. But that was in, that's an infection rate of 2.6. And on Saturday, when we tested 1,300 fewer than we tested on Friday, it was up to 2.9%. That's frightening.
Well, that's a question. The numbers are frightening, but evidently it hasn't frightened the public who have not been vaccinated to seek a vaccination. There are people I hear that are now begging the doctors, can you help me? I've got COVID. And the doctors simply advise, well, it's too late. There's nothing we can do about it now. So either you survive or you don't survive. But the question is, why did the message not, was the message unclear? Did the CDC, by changing the best practice over time, and it got so confusing, people said, the hell with it? What went wrong? And we don't have good local messages either.
We do not have good facts from the local areas. I mean, I haven't seen one city or town saying we have to have better masking policies in the last week. Kevin, now it is not rocket science. You can figure out you're in trouble.
Well, in Yonkers, we haven't had any of that.
No,
we don't even talk
not.
About the numbers. We don't.
And
talk,
you're back,
we don't even mention it.
On top of that, as far as Yonkers goes, we have not had an update on how many active cases Yonkers has had in about 5 days. Supposedly, we update that daily. Well, the county hasn't been. But perhaps that means the state hasn't been. You know, we don't know why those numbers are staying steady, because I know they're going up.
Well, that's the point. There seems to be a deception that's being promulgated by the county and the cities, and we're not being told what the numbers are. And I don't know why they have to hold it close to their vest. Who are they protecting? Are they protecting their
political
themselves? Prospects?
They're protecting themselves. I mean, it's all about protect themselves. It's like, look, the county executive, George Latimer, came out Friday afternoon saying he wants to make sure all county employees are vaccinated by Labor Day, all right? Perhaps he should have been pushing that about 4 or 5 months ago.
Mm.
Now, that is the big question. Why do we not know how many county employees are vaccinated? Shouldn't we know that? I would, if I were the county executive, I would bug them to get vaccines and really find out. You know, you don't have to make it mandatory if people don't want to tell you whether they've gotten vaccinated or not. That's your answer.
Well, but, you know, I'll be honest.
The county gives out. The county gives out. Not the county, but the state gives out vaccination records when you get the shot.
Right.
It should not be a mystery who employed by the county has gotten vaccinated.
It just
occurred to me right now.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. You know, an unknown factor. What I don't understand is how many people have to die before we start to realize there's got to be a better way around this. Are we just, you know, traipsing around this whole issue? For what? To what end? It's not going to end. We hear that there's another variant coming, even more virulent than the Delta virus.
Well,
this one's
hope
called
not.
Lambda. It is.
Hope is what we have right now, because we are getting so much misinformation. Just before we went on the air, of an acquaintance of mine informed me that, she knows a chemist that she knows that says that the nose test wasn't reliable. Well, who cares whether it wasn't reliable or not? People were getting COVID anyway. Second guessing and casting aspersions on decisions that were being made based on the best thoughts at the time is a problem. Second guessing never helps. This is not a baseball game. This is human life that's at stake, and perhaps the real future of the continuing functioning of this country, because the more but I feel the CDC made a huge mistake about relaxing the mask factor about when they do that, about a month ago. And then they're back to, hey, you got to mask up again. That's a big mistake. That was a big mistake because I believe that they deliberately did that to kind of get the economy going. So the Biden administration, now this is just speculation on my part, but I would think that the Biden administration wants the economy roaring by elections, okay? No matter what they are.
By which elections? You mean by the elections in 3 years?
Yes. Well, no. It's the elections coming up, okay, in the fall. The elections coming up next fall. I mean, they want the economy to be totally recovered, because if it is not totally recovered about a year from now, they will have a real Republican challenge for the presidency, because they have enough. That's what I look at it. This is seriously. Merely to keep the recovery going, however flighty it is. That's why they lifted that, and now they're back in the soup again.
Well, because it seems to me that we're spending more time politicizing this issue and taking sides one way or the other when the CDC should be informing us from a medical perspective, from a scientific perspective, the best practice. And we can't be wavering back and forth, because at the end it confuses people. And
absolutely.
And I don't understand why Madison Avenue, the ultimate advertising network in the world probably, they haven't been able to concoct a message that seems to be lucid and is it resonates with the public. And I wonder if our concept of ourselves as Americans is to have our rights, protected, we can do whatever we want, but can we do whatever we want even though when we're not vaccinated we could be carriers? Even when we are vaccinated, people are getting a second wave. They're getting the new Delta virus that's infecting them. How are we going to put an end to this? This is like a stupid little game. Might as well let drop dead when you drop dead, and it's all over when eventually peters out. And the ones that will survive will be the only ones that will survive. Because I don't know what we're doing. I really don't get it.
I don't know what we're doing in this state. I mean, Governor Cuomo is sort of not really going at this like he used to. I mean, he's letting it all fall on the Assembly and the State Senate, and they are immobilized because they don't want to jeopardize the recovery, their recovery.
But isn't it interesting? Everybody's interested in the politics of it all, because it's
absolutely
all about them. When is it going
to
become
all
about us, the voter?
Yes, like
including the people who don't vote.
Yeah.
And maybe it's time for everybody to vote. It's getting to be ridiculous that we're playing this game. What was it, 300 years after we created a nation? I mean, come on. When is this going to stop?
Yes. It's not going to stop until the Republican Party is resoundingly turned out of the many offices they hold in many positions they hold in Washington.
Well, I got to ask you a question. Do you really believe that the Republicans are creating this problem exclusively on their own? Is there nobody that's actually, helping them? Like the Democrats, they're not helping them? What's the difference between a Democrat and a Republican at this point, tell me? Do you know? Because I don't.
Well, they're passing an infrastructure bill, which is essentially a pork barrel legislation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And no matter what, and this is supposedly going to really pump up the economy and all that. But
that's
look,
what they say.
How about
that's
pumping
say,
up life savings? How about pumping
that.
Up life saving? You know, how about pumping up real dedication to solving the COVID problem? I mean, and I think what the problem is that they are not going to, they're not biting the bullet, and by executive order, the president saying everyone in America who is not vaccinated has to be vaccinated, otherwise there will be consequences.
Well, you know, that's what I got to ask you. Maybe I'm just not connecting with it. Well,
yeah.
I don't know why the people in politics don't connect to it. Why is it if you're not vaccinated, if you choose not to be vaccinated, that's your business, and you stay unvaccinated, no problem. So how about if you choose to go shopping, you will have to get it delivered to your door, and that's the only way you're going to get it, because you're not going to be allowed into the store because you choose not to be vaccinated, and you can't go into a restaurant. You can't go into a public building. You can't go to the theater. You can't go to a movie. You can't do anything anywhere if you're not vaccinated.
And if your child is not under the age of 12, your child has to be vaccinated. They want
to
go back to school. I mean, this is a no-brainer, which I do not believe anyone wants to do in Westchester County, and none of the school districts want to do it.
Where do they want to do it, John? Don't demonize Westchester County. What about the rest of the country? Anybody doing that? No. Nobody's doing anything like that.
No.
So the point is,
everybody's going to want to send the children back to school, and who knows what's going to happen to them if they're not. That's right.
The kids are getting infected now, John. We thought they would never get infected, but they are getting infected. And if they're not infected, they're carriers. So they just don't go through the same process as older people who get more destabilized. But the point is, if you want your child to go to school, then you get your act together. You've got to be vaccinated. Your children have to be vaccinated. And you can be assured that everybody else is going to school is also going to be vaccinated. And what's the problem when wearing a mask? Really, what's the problem? Why do people go crazy?
I wear one. Yeah. I mean, it's the
I never used
what
to
I
wear
do
one.
Is in case I have the germ, which has been a new wrinkle pointed out, that persons who've never had COVID or a person who's been vaccinated may be carrying or the germ, and because they're vaccinated, the germ hasn't given them COVID yet. I mean, that came out over the last few days. I mean, and that's why you have to wear a mask, but according to the CDC. But really, they should not have revised the mask rules, because that made everybody think it was over.
Yeah, well, the problem is that they keep changing it so rapidly.
Absolutely.
The emphasis is what? What are they trying to do? They're trying to open up the economy. The economy is not opening up
because people
are vaccinated.
Yeah.
Well, but it's not working, is it? Because many people are not being vaccinated. And
we keep getting reports about how the economy is turning around, but it's not going to roar back. I mean, people don't want to go to work. They don't want to go into the workplace. The companies are really
they're not going to the workplace, but they do want to work, and they can work, but they can work out of home.
Absolutely.
But not everybody works out of the home, do they?
Should have said they don't want to go to work. That's what I should have said.
Okay. Well, the thing is, there are a lot of people who are very vulnerable. Even the people that are working at the fast food restaurant or the supermarkets, yeah, these are essential workers, because if you don't fill up the shelves, you're not going to be able to buy any food. So I don't know if there's a better way to do this. Hey, maybe what we have to do is say, give me a list of whatever it is you want to buy. You can wait online, and we have our own shoppers inside, and they're going to pick whatever you want. And then see you, and goodbye.
True. Yes, you like know, the ration shops in Cuba.
Yeah, that's right. But I don't understand what we're trying to do, because it's not being done. The message is unclear. The CDC keeps changing their mind because they say best practice, but it's not best practice. They're trying to ameliorate the government.
It's what we think is best practice.
No, that's what they think is the best practice, but they're ameliorating the issue because they want to serve the government rather than to serve the public health crisis. And that's the problem. I don't understand how it can be different.
Yes.
And are we going to win?
I agree with you. The CDC has lost a lot of credibility.
Are we going to win the economic war if in China they're going to be able to shut everybody down, keep them, you know, in their apartments, arrest them or shoot them if they come out and they don't do what they're supposed to do? They can do that there. How are we going to compete when everybody there is willing to do whatever the government tells them to do? And here, we want to be free to be who we are. You know,
yes,
and we don't want to abide by the best practice. And we don't even know what the best practice is anymore. I'm confused.
Well, I would just keep on masking.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, masks truly did stop the COVID wave last year. They did. And
it's interesting too, you know, besides that, the wearing masks not only stopped the COVID from infecting a lot of people, but isn't it interesting? It's the flu season as well. And a lot of less people got the flu because they were wearing masks. So the point is, you know, this worked. It worked.
Of course it worked.
But we
got to
remember that.
And besides, they miss a tremendous fashion opportunity.
That too as well. You know, I've got to ask you, what about Dr. Amler, Shalita Amler? She's the Westchester County Health Commissioner and the Commissioner of Health, and she's reminding us now about mosquito repellents and the Nile virus and COVID-19 pandemic. But I don't really hear a solid, consistent message from her. It's like she comes out every blue moon and tells you something, and then she goes back and hides.
Yes.
What is she
doing? Well, I thought the Westchester the West Nile virus announcement should have been coupled with a COVID announcement. She should have addressed both issues at the same time and used it as a suggestion of how we have to be aware of this other problem, because West Nile virus can kill you if it's not treated and not diagnosed. I mean, I had a friend that died of West Nile virus, which the doctors could not diagnose until he was dead.
Yeah.
True
story. That's a bit, absolutely. I feel bad about your loss, that's for sure.
It was a stunner. We thought he had COVID or something. But
I'm wondering about something very pertinent, and that is the question of
Amler has to be used more than she is. I mean, she's a brilliant person.
She's not being used. How do you know
she's
brilliant?
She has to be used well.
Brilliant.
She has a sheet. No, wait,
oh,
wait.
Great.
I just want to say that Amler should be interpreting what these sharply inflating Westchester numbers mean and how many cases they could mean in a couple of weeks, because I'm trying to figure that out, but it takes a professional
Donna,
to do
it's
that.
It's a pecking order. She listens. She does what she's told to do. She's not independent, evidently. Otherwise, she would warn us about all these things. And
I think
problem.
So, too.
I
think it must be – I think she must be absolutely – distraught that she hasn't been able to give out more information.
Well,
I would
feel sorry for her that she's distraught, but you know what?
I'm just thinking that I would be if I were in that position. I would be if I was in that position and couldn't say as much as possible to address the seriousness of the situation and how these new infections are going to explode.
How come she's not?
Well, I cannot
even care
explain
why she's
that.
Not. You know what? I don't really care what she does. All I know is she's not doing the job. That's all that matters to me at the end of the day, because she's the one that's making it a mess, because she's not telling us the truth. And if she told us the truth, maybe it would be a little bit better.
The truth,
you know, come on,
always,
you've got to stop.
The truth always sets you free.
Yeah, great. I love those platitudes that mean absolutely nothing to most
people
who prefer to lie or to deceive.
Right, but but now we live in an era where there's a thought that, well, we really can't tell them how bad something is because it'll upset them and we will look bad.
Well, you know, they got to get over it.
That's the new thought, but it's always been that.
You know what? Just because it's always been doesn't mean it needs to be. Does anyone ever have the stamina and the mental integrity to tell it the way it is? Or are they just there for what? Why are they getting paid? Why are they being elected? When are we going to get something in response to this issue? I'm not freaked out. I'm taking the best care I can of myself based on the fact that it's widespread and it's a problem. You know, so you could just do so much. Hey, there was there was an assembly member in Yonkers. He was vaccinated last year. He got COVID again. One is, it can happen, and Delta virus is doing it. And then there's another one coming up the food chain. This is ridiculous. Anyway, I don't understand what she's doing, but I'm not happy because I know she's not doing the job. She's not debunking a lot of stuff that needs to be said, and she's not doing it, and I don't get it. We don't
as the old White Plains Common Council personality, Rita Malmud, once said, I don't have enough information, and that is the case today.
Okay, well, that's
we don't have enough information, and we don't have enough analysis of the information you do have.
Yeah, well,
not enough analysis.
Before you start, we got 1 minute left, so you'll have to be real quick. Mimi Rocha, she's expunged 184 marijuana felony and misdemeanor arrests on possession charges. I personally am in favor of that. How do you find yourself on that?
I think it's how it proceeds ahead. How are the police going to react to this, and how will it change the atmosphere on the streets? We don't know yet.
Well, no, we don't know yet. So we'll see if this works. Hopefully it does. Because a lot of people
certainly will clear the calendar.
Not because they were selling marijuana, but because they were black. That's all. They
went
to prison. And the white people didn't go to prison.
Yeah.
Well, nobody seems to point it out. They keep forgetting. Anyway, John, unfortunately, I can't believe it. 29 minutes later, we're at the end of our line here. So always invigorated. I appreciate your perspective, because it matters. And I know you study this so well. So
it just makes me sick every day when I see these numbers going up on much smaller test counts. That means it's much more widespread than it was in April. And that's what people don't realize. because the lower you test, more your infection rate appears to be. But, of course, that means when you have a high amount of tests, you're going to have much more cases because it is wide, it is relatable. It's relatable to what the lower tests are. So that's what I'm seeing happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
bad scene. Everybody should mask
John,
up
all the best
and
to
get
you.
Vaxxed.
Okay, well, we have to say goodbye to you, so just have a great week. Thanks so much, John. All the best.
Well, it's
Bye.
Never a great week.
Okay, well, let's move on to Michael Edelman. He's the national political analyst and pundit. And so good morning, Mr. Edelman. How are you, sir? Hello? You see what happened here? For some reason, we can't seem to hear Mr. Edelman. Okay, we'll just have to disconnect this, and hopefully he'll call back, and because I don't know what went wrong there. And so we'll see in a moment what's happening. One second here. Okay. We got a lot to talk about, actually, today on the national stage. So we'll have to see where all this goes. We may become disconnected from him for some reason. Well, we're hoping to cover a few things with Michael Edelman. Sarah Palin, she's a former Alaska governor and a Republican vice presidential nominee in the past, as you remember. She's hinting that she may run for the U.S. Senate, challenging incumbent Lisa Murkowski. So the question is Donald Trump's influence revealing his unchallenged position as titular head of the Republican Party? So that's going to be very, very compelling to find out what's what there and see where that goes. Okay, there we are. Okay, we're trying to bring in Mr. Edelman. Good morning, Mr. Edelman. How are you, sir?
Hi, Hezzy. How you doing?
Thank God. Okay. I hope we didn't mess up your earlier call, so I apologize for that. I wanted to ask you about Sarah Palin. She's claiming or suggesting that she may run against Murkowski.
Good.
Why would she even contemplate that? She was a failed candidate as a vice president. I don't know how well she did in Alaska before.
She resigned. Well, she resigned as governor.
Yes. So why would you think she's got,
she's
credibility?
She's a Trump supporter, and she's a Trump sycophant,
yes.
And she thinks Trump's going to endorse her against Lisa. Lisa Murkowski won the last time as a write-in candidate.
Correct.
She won as a write-in candidate. Nobody's going to beat Lisa Murkowski because she voted to impeach Donald Trump because that was the appropriate vote based on what he did.
Well, so a lot of things are revolving around Trump again all of a sudden. It's like, it seems like there's a resurgence of the COVID virus, but there's also a resurgence of Donald Trump. He's evidently raised $102 million in political cash.
Yeah, and he's not spending any of it.
I'll bet
you he takes it for himself. He'll take it for himself. He'll spend it on his properties.
Well,
he's a grifter. He's grifting.
Exactly, he is. So it is very, very compelling, though, the people that are supporting him with cash, what do they think is going to happen? There is a divide in the nation. It's not quite 50-50, maybe 40 on the Republican side, maybe 60% on the Democratic side. Where is this supposed to go, then? What does he think he's going to be able to do?
He has planted in the minds of some of his followers that somehow he's going to be reinstated in August. And he's raising campaign cash based on the fact that he's claiming that the election was stolen and that he needs to challenge Arizona, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. But the fact of the matter is he hasn't given any money to challenge the votes in those states. He's kept all that money for himself in his PAC. He's going to spend it on himself. He's not going to spend it on anything else. Well, he's going to siphon $100 million to his properties.
That's going to be huge. I wonder if that's going to be able to stand up against public interest who are going to probably sue him, I would think. But maybe he has the right
sure
to spend the money as he chooses.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's a political action committee, and I think it can do whatever it wants with the money, frankly.
Wow. Well, that's going to be very, very telling. It might inform the people who support him that this is not the way to go.
Well, but they're being conned. They've been conned for 5 years into giving money to Donald Trump. You know, it's like he's spinning a yarn and he's fundraising and he's got $102 million.
It's amazing to me. I don't know how he did that. Well, I wanted to ask you about something else with regard to the COVID pandemic. And interestingly enough, there is a coupling of the COVID with a record number of firearms that are being sold. But the thing that's fascinating is that there's a lack of ammunition to go around. And it seems that people are looking for ammunition. They're buying it from abroad. They're trying to keep it in store here. It's not happening. So many people are owning guns now, and more purchases are being made in guns. Are we preparing for a civil war? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, Republicans were asked in a poll whether they thought they would have to take matters into their own hands if Donald Trump was not reinstated, and 60% of them said yes, they thought they might. You have a thread in the Republican Party on the hard right, which believes that one day they're going to have to go to the streets to preserve their white Christian nation. But that's not going to happen. You've got the Army, the Navy, the FBI, the CIA. They're not going to allow them to do that. And so they can buy as much ammo as they want. It's not going to make a difference.
Well, let's hope not, because it's getting a little crazy. Well, in the wonderful state of Florida, and that everybody wants to visit at one time or another, or vacation, or live there, evidently the pandemic has really gone through to new heights, and there were like over 10,000 people hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19.
Yeah, more than at the height of last winter. More than at the height of last winter.
So, what can be done, and why do we have so many people that are not vaccinated even today? Did this all begin under the time of Donald Trump? And people got confused, and they politicized it rather than look at the medical technology or the best practice. And is the
That's
CDC
exactly right.
helping? Is the CDC
well, the
helping
CDC
because
is,
they're confusing people?
It has equivocated, and I'm not sure the CDC has spelled out their policy very well. But you have Fox News opinion hosts telling people the vaccine doesn't work. You've got pastors and evangelicals telling them the Delta variants is a hoax. And you've got a lot of people on Facebook. They read. They think that's news. You know, there are 12 people that are posting false information on Facebook, which would lead people not to trust the scientists. They're 12. That's all there is. There's 12 people posting about 80% of the disinformation. One of them is this guy, Anthony Mercola, who spouts real nonsense constantly, and people who are not sophisticated in terms of understanding that Facebook is not news, it's just opinion, and that Fox News opinion host is not news, it's just entertainment, and they listen to what they're told, and they do accordingly. So you couple that with a governor in Florida by the name of DeSantis, who wants to be the nominee in 2024 for president, and who wants to con, just as Trump did, the Trump base. And so he denies that masks are effective, which they are, and he doesn't urge people to get vaccinated. As the mayor of Miami said yesterday, he's the Pied Piper of the unvaccinated, and he's primarily responsible for the increase in COVID cases and deaths. And they will continue to increase until people get vaccinated.
Well, when is Madison Avenue or its equivalent, you know, in advertising, is the message not strong enough to convince people that they're likely to, they could get infected, not that they're likely to be infected, but they could get infected more easily if they're not inoculated than if they were? And I hear stories that are written over.
It's 25 times more likely. Not more easily. It's 25 times more likely to get sick if you're not vaccinated.
Why do people want to take that chance? That's what I don't understand.
They get mixed signals. They get mixed signals from the media. You have people that are dishonest who are on television. They're dishonest.
Yeah.
They want to undercut Joe Biden. They don't want Joe Biden to be able to say, I fixed it. They don't want that. They don't care who dies. They just don't want Joe Biden to be able to claim a win.
I know you've said that quite often, and I do believe that. I didn't originally, but I see that it seems that the people who postulate one concept over the other are doing it for their own political gain, and it's all about them. It's not about the public health crisis we're going through.
That's correct.
And yep. I'm just in shock that's – these are the people we've elected to office. What are they afraid of? Can't anybody speak up and tell it the way it is?
They're afraid of being pilloried by Trump and the right-wing media. You've got Newsmax, you've got OAN, you've got Fox News. They are afraid of being in the trademark, in the sites of these media opinion people. That's what they're afraid of.
It's amazing. But it's amazing that so many people have been quieted or muzzled by their desire to stay in power, and yet at the same time, they seem to think that they can get away exonerated from any responsibility of where we're going to. And we're getting more and more people that are polarized.
That people who rely on the information they are getting, which is disinformation, and become sick and or die, should file a class action lawsuit against Fox. That will solve the problem. Just like the Dominion voting machines filed a lawsuit of $1.6 billion, forcing Fox to disown its own commentators when they speak falsely about the election. They run a chyron on the bottom of the screen saying this is not true, while their own people are spewing this nonsense. The same thing would happen if they had a $1 billion class action lawsuit by all these people who relied on Fox News, and I predict that it will happen eventually, and they're going to have to run that same chyron saying get the vaccine, the vaccine. Even on your site, Hezzy, you got people saying the vaccine doesn't work. That is not true.
I know.
That is simply false.
It shouldn't be an opinion. I just don't understand why there isn't enough understanding, and why people are not smart enough to figure out that their life.
Oh, you don't understand you don't understand why people are not smart enough. Really, they didn't go to school. They don't know how to critically think. They dropped out of high school. You drop out of high school, you can't critically think. You think what you know is the truth because you know it. You don't challenge. Maybe you don't know what's going on because there's more than one source of information. So you simply want to reinforce the bias that you already have. And in this case, the bias is that you think you know the answers because you read it somewhere or you heard it somewhere. You didn't do research. You didn't ask the scientists. You're just going along with the nonsense. That spoon, that's all it is. So you don't understand why people are low information voters.
Absolutely, it seems that's becoming more and more evident. I never really thought that we had that sort of a voter out there, but evidently we do. Well, I want to ask you about something else that's probably the most compelling thing. The Justice Department, in a reversal, says that the Treasury Department must provide the House Ways and Means Committee former President Donald Trump's tax returns.
Yeah,
and
that's correct.
So a 39-page memo issued by the Treasury Department's legal counsel. This is huge. So evidently,
yes.
This is the law allows this. So this is going to happen.
Yeah.
Maybe that's
sure.
where the $102 million that that Trump has already gained, you know, in support of his whatever, is going to go to try to fight this any further. Or can he fight it any further? Is this the end of the line?
Well, they can appeal it. No, they can appeal it.
Oh, they can
appeal it? I believe they can appeal it. Oh, yeah, I think so. But the fact of the matter is two courts have already ruled that he's got to turn it over. He's going to have to turn it over. And then we're going to see where the income comes from, and I'm going to bet you that the loans come from Deutsche Bank, and that the source of the loans are dirty money from Russian oligarchs.
Yeah. Well, you've been saying that for years, and
correct.
I think you're right. It's truly amazing. Where are we now? Are we just in a muddle? Are we just confused? We hear messages from the Republicans. We hear messages from the Democrats. The Democrats seem to be split as well between progressives and maybe not so progressive. Where is the country? Are we confused? Do we need to wait a little bit longer to understand where Biden is taking the country?
No, we have to wait a little bit longer to disabuse the people that still think the election was stolen from thinking that, and that's going to take a little while. You've got the January 6th hearings. They took testimony from four police officers who were brutally beaten during the onslaught. It was an insurrection, and we're going to find out that Donald Trump was sitting in the television room of the White House cheering it on. We're going to find out that he wanted it to happen. He didn't call it off because he thought he could hold on to power if only Mike Pence would do what the Constitution did not allow him to do, which is send the votes back to the states to be recertified. That would never happen. He did what he had to do. But Trump held on to the last minute. Donald Trump is an authoritarian, and he stooped to whatever level he had to try and hold on to power. That's what it was all about.
Does he have any prospect left? Or, I mean, it looks like he wants to run again. And
he can't run again. It's a practical matter. By the time we get to 2024, we're going to know so much about what went on in the Trump administration, the people around him, the cheating, the stealing, the grifting. He won't be a viable candidate.
So do the Republicans have anybody else that they can conceivably throw up?
Oh, yeah.
Or
they got a lot of
the party dead?
They got a lot of people that can run, but you got Ron Johnson. I'm sorry, not Ron Johnson. Ron DeSantis. You've got Josh Hawley. You've got Ted Cruz. You got Nikki Haley. You've got the governor of North Dakota. I forget her name. All these people are going to try and get the nomination. Frankly, I hope Donald Trump does run again and gets trounced. That's what really needs to happen. He needs to run again, and he needs to lose badly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that would destroy him if he loses, you know, when he has a second opportunity. Unbelievable. Where do we go from here? Why is the nation somehow confused? It all goes back to, I guess, the message is not clear enough. Why aren't we more clear? We're not more clear on the virus. We're vacillating back and forth. Is that the problem in our system, or is that just the problem because of the differences of the states and their economies and so on and so forth? and education.
We have a problem. We have a problem because unvaccinated people are getting disinformation, and they refuse to cooperate with the nation, with the benefit of the nation. That's the problem. We never had this before. You never had anti-vaxxers.
No.
You never had people trying to blow up the government by not wearing a mask. These people have to either die or get very sick, and that's the only way it's going to stop. And it's going to take a while to do that. The fact of the matter is, you can't send your kid to school without 5 vaccinations. So that's never been an issue. Now it is.
Well, I thought at one time there was a big issue about vaccinating the children when it came to go to school. And then at one time, I don't know if this has been expunged now, but at one time the very Orthodox Jewish community in north of Westchester County, they refused to give the vaccinations to the kids, and they were permitted to do that, but it didn't work. I haven't they thrown that out, or is that still legal to take your kid, to school if they don't have the vaccinations? I thought you get the measles, rubella, and
right, mumps, polio, all of them, smallpox.
Yeah.
No,
so you can't get away with not doing that, can you?
That's correct. No, and that's never been an issue nationwide. It may have been an issue in individual small communities like the Hasidim, but that's not representative. That's not every state that voted for Donald Trump. You got every single state that supported Donald Trump, that watches Fox News, that has the highest unvaccinated numbers in the country. All the states that voted for Joe Biden, they got vaccinated.
Yeah. Well, I hear a lot of people are going to the doctors now that they've become infected, and they say, can you give me the vaccine? And the doctors tell them it's too late. It's just too late.
That's
can't
right.
Do
it's
it.
Too late. That's exactly correct. People are dumb people, and the only way this is going to end is when enough of those people get the disease and say to their family, I should have gotten the vaccine, and to their friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the only way it's going to end properly. So
it's
listen,
really
Andy, I have to excuse myself a little early today. I've got a doctor's appointment. I'm parked.
Well, you go
right at the
take
doctor.
Care of your health because that's the most important. We need a lucid voice
right.
on the station. All the best to you, sir. Thank
all
you
right.
very much.
Thanks, Jesse. You're welcome.
There we have it. Michael Edelman, national political analyst and pundit, and I find him brilliant. What's most brilliant about him is that because of his connections, because of his insight, because of his intuition, but it's not based on just intuition, it's based on facts. He knows people. And you don't need to know who he knows, but you can reflect upon what he's said in all the years that he's been on with us, for example. If you reflect back on what he said and you look at history, you will see he's been on target every step of the way. And he's been on target, not just like a day before, months before, a year before. He knows what he's talking about, and it is so difficult to find people who have so much knowledge and also are willing to share what they do know. A very, very influential man. And I'm honored that he takes the time to give us the time of day so that we can get a better understanding of what's going on as well. Well, at 11 o'clock, we're going to be joined by none other than Ron Matten. He's an endorsed Yonker City Council president, Republican candidate, vying to serve as Yonker's next city council president. And he's going to speak to the challenges they're faced by those vying to serve the public interest in the political arena, and what matters when he's running or when running for elected office. Questions are, is political dogma important? Is personality, ethics, demeanor, attitude, integrity central? Or what about education, knowledge, and a resume of accomplishments and employment? And the question is, are the attributes to which we gravitate changing? And if so, how and why? So he's going to be on at 11 o'clock. We'll talk to him then. In the meantime, I'm going to go back to, one second, we'll go back to our screen. One second here. Tell you sometimes you press a button on these computers and you think it's going the right way, but somehow it grabs onto something else and it doesn't always work well. So bear with me a second here. All right, one second. One moment. Okay, so this, I want to make sure this is correct. Yeah. Okay. All right. I think we're okay. We got back to the studio screen. We're only about 4 minutes away from Mr. Madden. And so before we go there, okay, I'll do one particular thing with you. And one second, we're going to go over to the, where are we going now? Oh, yes. Okay. Sometimes I wonder how I keep it all together because I don't know. Okay. This is really very, very interesting. So there's a battle going on in Japan. Evidently, Poland has granted the Belarusian Olympic sprinter a humanitarian visa. Thank God for that. Poland has granted a humanitarian visa to Krystyna Szymanowska. She's a Belarusian Olympic athlete who claimed her team tried to force her to leave Japan. And Poland's deputy foreign minister said that on Monday. Sprinter Krystyna Szymanowska plans to leave for Poland in the coming days, a Polish deputy foreign minister by the name of Marcin Przydasz told Reuters. She is safe and in good condition, quote unquote, after walking into the embassy on Monday morning, he said. Another deputy foreign minister, Paweł Jablonski, had said, I can confirm that we have issued a humanitarian visa. I can confirm that we will provide all necessary support in Poland if she wishes to use it. Szymanowska, 24, had been due to compete in the women's 200-meter heats on Monday, but she said that on Sunday she was taken to the airport to board a Turkish Airlines flight. She refused to board the flight, telling Reuters, I will not return to Belarus. Well, the incident has put renewed attention on the political discord in Belarus, a former Soviet state that is run by President Alexander Lukashenko. And police have there have cracked down on dissent following a wave of protests triggered by an election last year, which the opposition says was rigged to keep him in power. Well, the athlete pulled up in front of the Polish embassy in an unmarked silver van about 5 p.m. local time. She stepped out with her official team luggage and then greeted two officials before entering the premises, two women, one carrying the red and white flag of Poland, considered the symbol of opposition in Belarus, also came to the gates to support her. Interesting, the color. Her husband, Arseniy Janevich, will join her in Poland, a Warsaw-based Belarusian opposition politician, it said. Thanks to the support of the Belarusian Athlete Solidarity Foundation, Szymanowska's husband is in Kiev, and he will join Krystyna, Paweł Latuszko had told Reuters. So, Janevich has already entered Ukraine, a Ukrainian Interior Ministry source, it said. And Szymanowska told a Reuters reporter via telegram that the Belarusian head coach had turned up at her room on Sunday at the athlete's village and told her she had to leave. The head coach came over to me and said there had been an order from above to remove me, she wrote in the message. And at 5 p.m., they came to my room and told me to pack, and they took me to the airport. But she refused to board and sought the protection of Japanese police at the airport. That was a smart move. So that's the story there. So we'll get back to other issues like that later. Let's go back to our studio screen, and I see our main man, Ron Matten, the endorsed Yonkers City Council president of the Republican candidacy. He's already online. So good morning, Mr. Mr. Matten. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you? It's a pleasure to
meet
with you and your audience again.
Oh, well, always a pleasure, because the more we know, the better it is, I think, at the end of the day. So,
that's why I'm here.
What do you think, before we even begin on what aspects define a particular candidate, you're running for Yonkers City Council president in the city of Yonkers, and can you explain what the role is of the Yonkers City Council president and vis-a-vis the entire governmental structure in the city? How does that work? How do you look at it?
Okay, the council president is an at-large council seat, meaning it's elected by the full city, but it's only has one vote as other the council members. I would say it's first among equals in terms of establishing agendas, rules, and voting within the council. And the job is to really build some consensus and to help the council at least understand through my eyes what the outcomes are that we're voting for. For instance, if we're looking at raising taxes and how that might impact the city overall, or if we're looking at an ordinance that says gas stations can be open 24 hours, how that might positively and negatively impact certain areas, and really getting feedback from the other council, how it affects their constituents. I think that's one of the things that's been missing over the last 4 years, is really working with the council, the other council members, to get that feedback from the constituents overall. It's a large job because you're dealing with the entire city, and the individual council members will have the best resources for getting that feedback. And again, I've worked with large organizations, City University of New York, the Town of Greenwich, large companies like Aramark. So I have different experiences than those currently on the council, so I can bring that in and share where I think certain legislation will go, certain restrictions and procedures might go.
So when you look at it from that perspective, and that's really quite succinct, how does the legislation come to the city council? Does it come from the mayor's office to you as a city council president? Should you be elected into office, or is there like a sit down, a powwow between the mayor and the entire city council of 6 districts, of which there is one representative for each of the districts, plus yourself, that would be the city council president? So is that the way it comes about, or do you just get a message from the mayor's office, the executive, and he's telling the city council what he wants done?
So budgets ultimately come from the executive branch, because it's the executive branch's budget. But other resolutions or other legislations come either from the mayor's office or come from the individual council members. For instance, the last one, the affordable housing measure at 20%, that was heavily pushed by councilperson Shanae Williams. So she put that through on her committee, and she worked to get that into the council agenda and voted on. That obviously was the mayor vetoed it, so obviously was something that didn't come from the mayor's office, but it did come from the council. It could come up through districts as well. There could be various districts looking for a curtailment on things that happened. I know Westchester County had just passed something to do with the the mufflers and the loud automobiles, but that could
the noise.
Yes. Right, so something along those lines could have very well come out of the council, something regarding, Yonkers has a law requiring cabaret licenses. That could be pushed by, let's say, bar owners, restaurant owners, or any type of businesses. So there are various constituents that can push this legislation through their council members. It can come from the administration, or it can come from some community groups. Or, you know, the neighborhood associations are very are very influential within their council.
So when something does come before the city council, no matter from what direction it comes from, whether it's the mayor's office or whether constituents of some form or from the particular districts, through the council people that represent that district, what then is the role of the city council president? Are you there to more introspectively define the issue to show the positive aspects or reveal also the negative aspects of particular legislation and how one will affect another? Is that part of your role to explain that?
Yeah, it is, and let me tell you how I look at that, because throughout my 30-year career, I've written policies for my department, and the policies have a lot of stakeholders in them. So I never write a policy or would enact a law that's in a vacuum. You really have to get a lot of input from your constituents, understand how the proposed legislation would affect them. For instance, something like, it's been booted around for a while, 24-hour store openings and gas stations. Well, yeah, you really have to go back to the constituents and understand how that impacts their lives, whether or not an increase in traffic. There has to be certain studies done. There has to be, in some cases, environmental impacts for some of these legislations. And you have to really weigh all of that out, form a hypothesis. It's really like doing research. Form a hypothesis and either test your hypothesis in some manner on a smaller scale or look at other case studies that have been put out there, other cities that have enacted similar legislation and seen where that's gone. So there's really a lot of research involved. Just to come out and say that you support something without researching it is lazy. If you can do that, you're only making a political statement. You're not really doing the work.
Well, it's so interesting. I remember years ago, and it's many, many years ago, I don't even remember. I'm very bad at trying to formulate, did it happen 5 years ago? Was it 10 years ago? Was it 15? I just never paid that much attention to all of that. I remember there was a case where there was a McDonald's that was open and 24 hours, and it was not legally allowed to be there open for 24 hours. And so wrote about it, and eventually it was that was rescinded their capacity to do so. Why do these things happen? Is that what also undermines the capacity of our government when we say one thing and something is done anyway, despite what's being said? Is what's being voted upon by the city council, endorsed by the mayor as well, so there's agreement? What do we do when these things happen and people go out of line? And to be honest with you, it's not like I go to McDonald's. I don't. I'm not offended in any way by it, but the point is a lot of people do go to McDonald's, but a lot of people didn't want it. They didn't want the traffic. They didn't want the noise. They didn't want the trucks coming in late at night and so on and so forth. How do we ameliorate all these other issues when all we have to do is vote yes or no? And do we have the knowledge to know what to do?
You know, it, it's it's important to get a sense of where the executive branch is on some of these things and why the executive branch feels it's either a good thing or a bad thing. Look, the mayor has access to information that the council members may not, or the mayor has history. And I'm not talking about Mike Spano in particular. I'm just saying the mayor and executive chief operating officer of the city. Also, the managers from various departments have experience with enforcing some of these regulations. And the council could decide in the best interests of everybody they want to pass a regulation. But, you know, the mayor can come back or one of his department heads can come back and say, you know, the regulation that you're proposing here is entirely unenforceable. And we don't have the means to enforce it. So, you know, you're spending time on something that's unenforceable. It's a waste of everybody's time unless you can develop a system in which the city can enforce that. So in that way, the mayor and the department heads, while they may not live in Yonkers and may not vote for the council, they're a very important constituent as well, because regulations that you impose on them tie up their resources. And if you're going to vote on this and the mayor is just going to turn around and say, I'm not in support of it for X, Y, Z, and veto it, it seems like you have to go back and do your research and come up with the thesis to support why the mayor should support it.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, the mayor, the executive branch is a constituent as well. Should or shouldn't, so you do want you need to partner with the executive branch. Pardon?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can't separate the two. They may be separate responsibilities, but you can't separate them. It's a symbiosis. It's got to be. Otherwise, nothing works.
Well,
right?
You need approval. There is a check and balance, but at the end, hopefully, both branches are working towards the betterment of the city, and that that's where you get the most progress.
What do you do in a situation that is contentious? For example, one of the big issues right now that came before the city council, which was, as you mentioned before, overridden by a veto by the mayor, was the 20% component for affordable housing. Now, I'm not going to weigh on whether it was or wasn't important or a valid point, but is the situation when it gets so, so emotional for a lot of people, or there's a great deal of passion for one direction or another, is there any time when you can have a private meeting with the mayor and the city council rather than a public meeting where it could get really quite contentious and then it can go out of control? Is there a mechanism to talk or not?
Again, a lot of things are back-channeled. You can't really, you know, the council can't get together without it being a public. You can't have a quorum without it being a public meeting. You know, once a quorum of the council is present, it then is required to be a public meeting. But you know, you can certainly have meetings between two council people, three council people, you know, a representative of the mayor's office. These are all important ways to plan and move the city forward.
That's a question in my mind. Like, okay, you can have a certain number of people in a room, and if you have a representative from the mayor, doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be open to appreciate what's being said, because they have no power. They just either mimic whatever they've been told or regurgitate whatever they've been told. So they're holding the line. But there is no, you know, relationship of accommodation if there's no way to openly discuss something. So maybe if only two people show up and speak to the mayor and then another two at another time, how do you protect people's sensibilities and their vulnerability emotionally? so that we can get things moving forward?
Well, again, I think that the mayor has the best interest in the city, as does our council, and it's just in the way in which you see the data and interpret it. Certainly, if you're dealing with, let's say, real estate issues, you know, it would be important to have John Rubo in the room, who is chair of the real estate committee, along with either the mayor or a representative. And you can work towards hammering out legislation that works for everybody. I'm not discussing any particular legislation at this point, but I'm just saying that the mayor, John Rubo, other council members have a point of view, and it's important to look at that through their eyes. I've done a lot of union negotiating in my career. I've managed different unions. We've negotiated contracts, and I've always tried to put myself in the seat of the union member and understand how they see their contract, so that you have that respect for them. You know, their labor is valued. And, so the work that the mayor's done, the work that the individual council members have done in order to put forth legislation, I look at the same way. That work is valued, and you don't want to dismiss it out of hand, because then you really disrespect the person and their work.
Well, I can appreciate all of that, but how do you get to the heart of an issue if you can't always discuss it on a private basis, or is that just not the way it's done? I would have thought that one could approach the mayor directly rather than to offend some people's sensibilities if you can do it in an open forum,
You absolutely can. It's just that you have to watch the numbers. You know, once you get to a quorum, it becomes a public meeting. You certainly can have meetings to develop legislation as long as it's within the numbers allowed by the charter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you talk about a city council of seven people and the mayor of one, what becomes a public hearing or public discussion?
I believe once you have four people meeting on an issue, it's a quorum. It's a quorum.
Okay.
And once you've established that quorum, then it becomes a public meeting. I believe that's, you know, the council meets under Robert's rules, and I believe that's that's how Robert's rules apply to public.
Okay, so I guess it's conceivable that the mayor would be on one side and the city council president on one side, and maybe conceivably two people with the committee interests that could also be engaged in discussion, so that you get a better sense of where the executive and the legislative departments of government, where they reside and where they want to go or what they want to accomplish. Why don't we hear validation so the public can understand and appreciate the outcome of some of these votes that are being taken, by the city council? Because there's very little validation.
I can't speak to the current council members. I'm not in their head. I can't speak. I can only speak to how I would like to run a council, and that would be trying to build consensus between the members, the executive branch, and again the department heads who have to enforce the legislation
mm-hmm.
or have to abide by the legislation that's created by the council. You know, I've had various people reaching out to me regarding, you know, my views on parking regulations, you know, people parking in front of the house, the ability to get fire trucks down their block. And those are all important.
Yeah.
Those are all important items. They sound like, you know, when you're dealing with a large city of Yonkers, it sounds a little minutiae. But when you have to worry about getting a fire truck down a narrow street and we've allowed parking on both sides, that's something that needs to be examined. You know, to make sure that we have adequate emergency services. This is just an example, you know, of something that I was contacted about. And these are mostly in the neighborhoods that are near train stations where the two-hour parking limit is not enforced and you have, you know, people parking on both sides of the street, and there tend to be narrow streets. So, I mean, these are all important constituent concerns that, as well as coming up through the council, can also come through the council president's office. And then that would be, that might be a meeting with the council and, say, the parking parking bureau to ensure that the regulations are adequate, and if they're not, what we can do to improve them. And if they are adequate, why there might be a resource issue in enforcing them. So these are just some of the exploratory issues.
Right. I wanted to ask you about something else, politics. Politics, we used to have a lot of different political parties. We now have, I think, a majority of voters in Yonkers have voted Democrat in the last few years. Republicans are, I think, in second place. And then you have some conservative party members, and there's working families as well, not very large. So the question is, when you run for political office and you're running as a Republican, you're an endorsed Republican candidate, and you'll be meeting the challenger on the Democratic side of the ticket. Is there anything that's specific to the party dogma that aligns itself more closely with one party or the other? Or are these old standards that linger on, and they seem to have very little to say for themselves, because there are so many people that used to be Republican at one time, they became Democrats, and then were Democrats, they became Republicans. We keep switching back and forth. What is dogma, what does political dogma mean anymore today in a city like Yonkers?
Well, a wise man once said, Yonkers is a little bit country and a little bit rock and roll. And I take that to mean that, you know, I don't believe we have a lot of ideologues in Yonkers. I think Yonkers is fairly mainstream. You know, people want to hold on to the money that they've earned. We want to ensure that we have some good services for people who have some issues to fall back on. Look, I'm a strong believer, and again, this is a county issue, not so much a Yonkers issue. But you know, when we have strong public transportation systems, we're able to provide businesses with employees. Employees are able to get to work. So, you know, there are responsibilities for the city to provide clean drinking water, police protection, good services like waste removal, paving. We all know that's a little bit of a stretch sometimes in Yonkers, but street paving. We have a responsibility to provide services, and, you know, that's neither a Democratic nor a Republican dogma. Republicans tend to believe in a little smaller government, and Democrats like to have a little more services on the government. But at the end of the day, we all want a government that works for us, and that's really what I'm here for. I'm not an ideologue. I want to find the right way to provide the services to serve the people best, and also without gouging government, without borrowing too much money to do so, and without making it difficult for people to pay their mortgages and chasing people out of the city. There's a lot of variables to look at in that mix. You know, when you raise the taxes so high, people leave. A lot of people have moved out of Yonkers to go to Kent, Carmel, Mayapack, and they commute in because they can't afford to live in the city anymore. I'd like to keep our people here who've gone to Yonkers schools, who know Yonkers well, who work for Yonkers, who've been teachers, who've been police officers there, and who also work for the local communities, because they also pay Yonkers tax. Even if you don't own a home, mm-hmm. you're still paying income tax.
Right. Well, that's really, all those things are very pertinent, I believe. What is it, like, you bring a lot to the table. How is it, like, your experience at, for example, in Greenwich, how does that experience inform you and will inform the city under your tutelage of what can be done and protected? How do you bring something of value from your experience in Greenwich to the city of Yonkers?
At Greenwich, I managed 100 people, 15 schools, 1.5 million square feet, and two school construction projects where we built a performing arts center, about $50 million, and a roughly $60 million school. And that was all one, for the benefit of the taxpayer, and two, I also considered the employees my constituency there in Greenwich. I managed about a $15 million, varied a little bit up and down, $15 million, not counting the construction project, capital budget. I formulated the budget, and then I also had to abide by my operating budget as well as the capital budget. I always came in on budget, always had money to give back to the town. Some might call that being over budgeted, but I call that being right budgeted. If you don't do the proper maintenance on the schools, they get run down, and it's like overspending on your credit card every month. You can just never mm-hmm. catch up. That's very important for the health and welfare of the students, the families. They have to, you know, if you have a mold issue in the school, you know, that's going to impact the students, faculty, and staff. If you've got an uncomfortable learning environment, the students aren't going to learn. So, you know, it was formulating the right budget, living by the right budget, and I understand how these department heads have to operate and the challenges that they have. So, again, when formulating regulations, when deciding, or when appropriating money, I'm looking at it on both sides of the ledger. That's the people we're giving the money to, making sure we're getting the best value, and we're getting a service back to that money. And then the people we're taking the money from, which is a taxpayer, or if we're borrowing that money, the future taxpayers, and how that's going to impact the city and the ability for the city to develop further. If you borrow too much money, you start approaching your statutory limit, and you can't perform capital improvements in the future when you borrow too much.
I want to ask you, I didn't realize time has, you know, gone so quickly. It's like 28 minutes after the hour. Do you have a little bit extra time, or am I encroaching on your schedule?
I could spend a few extra minutes.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you about the, supposedly I think we're getting about $48 million over the next 2 years that comes from an infusion of funding from the federal government, and it goes to the state, and the state brings it down to the city, or maybe through the county to the city. But whatever, we're supposed to have like about, I think, $48 million over the next 2 years, which will allow the city to do many, many things. But there was an incident years ago in which $55 million was supposedly promised to the Yonkers Board of Education, and it turned out we spent $40 million before we realized we didn't get the $55 million. I always wondered, well, how the hell do we spend $40 million out of a promised $55 million, and the $55 million never showed up? So where did the money go, and how did we even have the means to spend $40 million? And then we had to borrow money to back it up, whatever. What do we do?
So that,
how do we plan? How do we plan for that $48 million, whatever the exact number is, and are assured that we won't be at a shortfall after we spend money, and we then find that it's not there? Is there a guarantee if they tell us that we're going to get it, we either get it or we don't get it? Or should we not spend a dime until we actually have it? Because I don't know if we actually validate it, that $55 million is supposed to come in, and who validated it. And I'm wondering if we're going to make a mistake again, or could, even not to our knowledge, if we don't acknowledge whether we got it and who gave it to us and why it's coming. Who's going to validate the money?
You bring an excellent point. What happened was we didn't have a school business administrator on staff at the time, and I believe an account clerk was doing the role. The school business administrator is a certified position. I was certified in Connecticut as a school business administrator. New York requires that you actually take about 30 credits, equivalent to a master's degree. And they also do give a master's of education in that program. But it's about 30 credits, and then you have to take a civil service exam, which validates your qualifications, and you actually know what you're doing. So we didn't have somebody in that role. The money got booked without it being in. I don't know the full details. I only read the IG's report, which stated that. But going a little further on your question, we have to start planning in year three, right? We're in year one. The mayor has proposed additional positions, which I believe were needed, particularly on the school side. We went for many years without having the right number of guidance counselors, without having the right number of social workers in the school. These are all important positions for what they call school climate. And this is what helps prevent these violent incidents that occur in schools when you have guidance counselors and you have social workers to identify students who could potentially have problems. So we're in year one right now. We have to be planning for year three because we are hiring these positions. Once you formulate a school budget, you are required to maintain that funding level in future years. So it's not like we can say, all right, we're going to give Yonkers schools $600 million this year, but you know what? Next year we're going to give them $590 million. It doesn't work that way. We have to continue to fund the minimum of that $600 million level. So we should be planning year three when we don't know if that funding is still there on how we go forward with making sure that we have proper revenue streams. Remember, we get a portion of the sales tax as a revenue stream as well.
Right.
We get some of the money for the Racino comes back to us, probably not as much as we should get. And every year we have the same mantra is that we need to get, except for this year, I think we're not saying it, but every year we go up to Albany, we have a protest on the steps at the Capitol saying, hey, we need more money. So we have to start that planning now, working with our counterparts on the state to see what's going to be available, having the proper algorithms to know what's going to come back on property and sales tax. Sales tax is a very important revenue provider. I believe this year our sales tax are up over projections, so that also helps us out. And then we have to make sure that we have enough in our reserve fund. If we want a proper reserve fund, we should be looking at about 7.5% as a minimum in our what they call the rainy day fund. That's monies left over every year that are swept in. We were recently criticized, on the school side, by Comptroller DiNapoli, because we have, we're depending too much on our budget for one-time revenue shots, like this money coming from the state and the reserve fund. These are all one-time revenue shots. We really need to broaden our revenue streams. I'm not going to advocate for a particular plan right now, because that calls for a meeting with the mayor and getting some consensus. But, you know, there's right now municipalities have the option to look at the sale of marijuana, cannabis, as a revenue stream. I think that's an avenue that needs to be explored. I'm not advocating for it yet. I haven't seen enough studies, but there are cities that have done this. We have to look at how this will impact our city. It's legal in New York State, so nobody's going to turn around and say pot's illegal in Yonkers. We have to decide of whether we want to be in that business or not. But that's a valid revenue stream that could add to revenue in year three.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish I could talk to you a little bit more, but the point is there comes a limit, and you got things to do.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Well, thank you. My pleasure. Before you go, how do people learn about your candidacy?
All right. My website is www.ron4yonkers.com. That's ron4yonkers.com. And I'm also been out campaigning through the city. So I'll see you at the events. I'll be at National Night Out on Tuesday. I'm going to hit all four events throughout the night. So I hope to see you. I hope to see the listeners out there at one of the four National Night Out events. So thank you very much for the time, Ezra.
My pleasure. All the best. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
There we have it. Ron Matten, who's running for Yonkers City Council President. And the election will be in November. So we'll have to see what goes on then, see where people stand. Let me just quickly see. This is very interesting because we're talking about COVID-19 and we're talking about a health pass. Some people are thinking about it. Question is, where is it going to be mandatory and what will change on August 9th? Not in the United States, mind you, but we're talking about what's going to happen in France. That might be a promulgator of what we may expect if that becomes a best practice. But France has made it obligatory to show a pass sanitaire or a health pass, proving that you are vaccinated or have tested negative for COVID-19 for access to public venues for more than 50 people. Since July 21. Well, on August 9, the health pass requirement will be extended to a range of new settings, including long-distance transport, restaurants and cafes, even France's famed outdoor terraces. Well, the controversial extension of the health pass that will come into force on August 9 has already sparked protests. But the government is determined to press ahead and make the pass a key part of the fight against COVID-19. Constitutional Council, that's France's highest legal authority, will rule on the new legislation on August 5. But the government is moving forward with its plans on the assumption that it will be approved and has said it will allow for a one-week adjustment period as businesses bring themselves into line with the new rules. Well, any of the following documents can be used as a health pass in France. Wonder if that's going to conform to us, you might want to think. Well, proof of having completed a vaccination program, two doses of a European Union approved vaccine, that is Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, or Johnson & Johnson, which are also approved here in the United States, a negative PCR or antigen test taken within the last 48 hours, so that's going to be proof, and a COVID-19 recovery certificate that is less than 6 months old. So anyone who enters an establishment without showing a valid pass can be fined. Are you sitting down for this? 135 euros for a first-time offense. So the question now becomes where a health pass is required. So from July 21, cultural and leisure venues of more than 50 people. So that includes things like cinemas, you know, movie theaters, libraries, nightclubs, discos, and bars with dancing, gaming rooms, casinos, museums, zoos, amusement parks and circuses, swimming pools and sports centers, theaters such as like on Broadway, concerts and festivals, indoor sports facilities, cruise ships and ferries, hotels, holiday resorts, and camping sites with swimming pools, playgrounds, or other entertainment facilities. But things are going to change come August 9. Cafes and restaurants, including outdoor terraces, fairs, trade shows, and conferences, care homes, it's like retirement homes and retirement facilities, and long-distance transport, such as airplanes, into city trains, the Tong Grand Vitesse, that's the speed, the high-speed train, overnight trains, long-distance buses, medical establishments, with the exception of emergency rooms, and then hotels, holiday resorts, and full-service campsites, with the exception of campsites that only offer accommodation, lodges, and guest rooms. So access to shopping centers is permitted unless otherwise decreed by local authorities in the event of a regional outbreak. And the health pass rules will apply to minors age 12 and over starting on September 30. The rules are set to apply until November 15 unless renewed by a parliamentary vote. So there's going to be a lot at stake here, and I wonder if these are some of the examples that will come into play or even be considered here in the United States as we also evolve some of the issues that are concerning the nation. So they've done what they've done. And now let's look at something else. Well, let's look at what's happening in Afghanistan. The Afghan fighting rages on as President Ghani blames the U.S. pullout for the Taliban advance. Well, Afghanistan President Ashraf Ghani blamed the country's deteriorating security on Monday on Washington deciding, quote, abruptly, end quote, to withdraw its troops. Quote, the reason for our current situation is that the decision was taken abruptly, end quote, he told Parliament, adding he had warned Washington the withdrawal would have, quote, consequences, end quote. So that's the way they look at these things there. So I thought it was known that the American troops were going to be leaving, not that it was abrupt. Actually, I don't know how to judge this statement by the Afghani President Ashraf Ghani. I mean, America's been there for 20 years, you know, propping up the country, cost billions and billions of dollars, and this is all he could say. Amazing. Well, problem also in Beirut. The Beirut blast has propelled activists from street protests to political action. You never know what could it be, what it can be. Well, Lebanon's economic woes and political mismanagement drove lawyer Hussein El-Akhi to take on the streets in October of 2019. The devastation of the August 4, 2020 Beirut blast and the political inference in the investigation convinced him to join the fight to change from the inside. And the question now is whether idealism, backed by political organization, can challenge Lebanon's sectarian kleptocracy. On the evening of August 4, 2020, Hussein El-Akhi was in his office in Beirut's Jinna district, around 8 kilometers, about 5 miles southwest of the port, when he was shaken by the explosion that would shatter his city, rock his world, and launch him on a path he never imagined he would take. The 33-year-old activist and lawyer by profession immediately thought it was a bomb, as did many in a city that has endured wars, political assassinations, and military strikes. He quickly checked on his loved ones and then headed down to the Gemayeh neighborhood, which had was badly hit by the blast. The next few hours were a blur of driving around trying to help dazed, injured people and locating missing friends. Elahi admits he wasn't very effective that day. The attention or the situation was so chaotic and the need so enormous. But the very next day, the seasoned activist swung into action with colleagues from Lebanon's protest movement. Elahi is the Secretary General of Mintashrin, an opposition party born out of the October 2019 anti-government protests that swept Lebanon. The movement name is a play on words. In Arabic, min means from, and Tishrin is October. So from October. Mintashrin is a one word, which means spread. Well, putting years of organizational experience to use, Elahi and his activist colleagues gathered all the tents and equipment they had amassed during the 2019 protests and took them to a park lot in the Mar Michael district right by the airport, or rather by the port. At the time, we were so disoriented and disturbed, we didn't even think that there were big buildings all around the parking lot. We were just working and setting up our operations and putting the medics here, food distribution there, the engineers and architects, mental health doctors, and then glass started falling on us, Elahi recalls with a laugh. We moved the camp a little bit on the first day, but then we realized huge pieces of glass were falling with the wind and the buildings were shaking. So we moved to a new spot. Well, within days, a tent city dubbed the Base Camp had sprung up, comprised of non-governmental organizations and volunteer groups offering a range of emergency services in the absence of a comprehensive state response. Well, but it was the first weekend after the blast that brought a change that would transform Elahi's life for the next 12 months. On Saturday of August 8, 2020, a year ago, tens of thousands of people gathered around Martyrs Square in downtown Beirut to demand the ouster of the government. And in an outpouring of anger against the corruption and negligence that protesters believed had enabled the port accident, they occupied ministries, set fires, and faced off against security forces. Crackdown that day hit unprecedented levels, with security forces using live ammunition and projectiles that caused massive injuries, according to rights groups. At least 492 people were injured, including 158 who had to be hospitalized. Well, the hospitalized protesters included 12 Mintashrin members, some severely wounded. The nature of the August 8 crackdown was different. According to AFP, forces arrived at hospitals to get the names and identities of wounded protesters. In some hospitals, arguments broke out when doctors refused to comply. With the government showing every indication of standing firm and security forces cracking down on a mourning populace that had lost loved ones, homes, and livelihoods in the blast of August 8, 2020, marked a turning point for Mintashrin. Before that day, and since our inception, we were an informed group doing protests and small events. Our numbers grew, but we always wanted to remain a movement. We didn't like the term political party. But on that day, all bloodied up, we met at a friend's apartment. And at that moment of desperation, we thought the street is an important tool, but we are facing a regime that is ready to kill us to maintain power. And that is why the only way to bring change is to get into organized political action. We needed to create a political party, and we all took a decision that Minta Shreen needs to turn into a political party, El-Ahi explains. Well, it became the birth of a political party in the making. The group, which currently has 167 core members, immediately swung into action. They split into three task forces, one to create internal structures and laws, the second to hammer out a political program, and a third focus on organizing elections. Town hall seminars were held on Zoom to discuss political ideology, platforms, and strategies. Coalition talks with other Lebanese civil society groups and political parties began, with an eye on parliamentary elections scheduled for next year. Sitting in his living room in Beirut's predominantly Shiite Jinnah neighborhood, El-Ahi rattled off details of workshops, seminars, and discussions with the frenzied intensity of a man on a mission. Well, lessons from his law school education as a scholarship student in the United Kingdom were put to use, including the value of time and alliance building. The Lebanese state works when and if it does at a different pace. Minta Shreen's party building process complete, El-Ahi and its fellow members presented their dossier to the Interior Minister early this year. The dance with Lebanese bureaucracy and the intimate pas de deux with official stonewalling had begun. At this stage, El-Ahi puts down his morning cup of Turkish coffee to fetch a folder of documents in Arabic to help explain the process. The authorization process for non-governmental organizations and the political groups can take a long time in Lebanon, with some LGBT groups still waiting nearly 10 years after filing their papers. Well, the Interior Ministry, however, has to supply a stamp receipt of applications. That's important because you can take it to a bank and open a bank account and be operational, because you really can't do anything without a bank account, he explains. Last week, Minta Shreen members once again went to the Interior Ministry to ask about the receipt. They promised us next week we will receive them. Let's see, he laughs. It's just one small tool in their arsenal. We're all barely making any money. So while the Lebanese state tries to put the administrative brakes on political change, the kleptocracy has run the economy into one of the world's worst economic crises in 150 years, according to the World Bank. The Lebanese lira has lost around 90% of its value to the dollar. Inflation is soaring and the liquidity crisis means that people don't have access to their savings, while the government can't pay for essentials such as fuel imports, making daily life miserable. Minta Shreen has so far funded its operations with cash chipped in by its members, who have jobs and businesses in diverse sectors. But they are all hurting under the economic crisis, and the lack of a bank account means they are unable to receive donations from this diaspora willing to fund projects working for change in Lebanon. Several Minta Shreen members have lost jobs, while El-Ahi says he has lost 70 to 80% of his legal accounts. We are all barely making any money, he smiles ruefully between puffs of an electronic cigarette. Well, the son of a litigator, El-Ahi, returned to Lebanon from the United Kingdom after his studies, much to his family's surprise, to expand his father's legal business. Born in Beirut and raised in Dahiya, Hezbollah stronghold in the Lebanese capital, El-Ahi graduated from St. Joseph University of Beirut, the country's leading Jesuit-run university, and is at home in many worlds. But for Lebanese Shiites, running as independent candidates, particularly in bastions of Hezbollah support, comes with risks. Hezbollah and Amal, the Shiite parties in a country run on sectarian political lines, have long had a stranglehold on the Lebanese Shiite vote. Hezbollah, in particular, has managed to achieve hegemony over the community using a combination of consent and coercion. But on the one hand, the Party of God, quote-unquote, provides services to a historically deprived community overlooked by the state via patronage networks. On the other hand, the group adopts repressive measures against community members who do not toe or who publicly question the line. During the 2018 parliamentary election campaign, independent Shia candidates were attacked in southern Lebanon by a bunch of Hezbollah thugs, according to one candidate. Hezbollah, however, denied any involvement in the attacks. So back in 2018, when Luqman Slim spoke to France 24, a Shia publisher and well-known Hezbollah critic, called the attacks pedagogical assassinations, quote-unquote, that sent a message to all the other independent Shiite candidates. 3 years later, Slim was found dead from a gunshot wound to his head in his car in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah once again denied involvement in the killing. In a country where political assassinations are rarely investigated, few expect justice in the case. So displaying the tact of a politician, El-Ahi sidestepped the question on the likely dangers of his political foray. He recalls instead the year 2000 Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon and a defeat that granted Hezbollah resistance hero status, which the movement continues to use to assert its dominance over Lebanon's Shiites. Back in 2000, I was 12 years old and I had never seen my village ever. Hezbollah liberated my village, and this is how I saw my village for the first time. So for me, it was a huge achievement, and I used to support them for that, he explained. But after a while, Hezbollah made a series of very wrong decisions. In my opinion, the climax was in Syria. Hezbollah's involvement in the wars in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen had lost the party a lot of Lebanese Shiite support, says El-Ahi. This is a resistance that turned into a cross-border army. For us, this is a big no-no. And after October 17 of 2019 and the total meltdown of the Lebanese state, this is another reason to re-question who are our representatives. Are they taking care of our daily lives? Hezbollah is also losing popularity in the Shiite community. It may be not at the same pace as the other sectarian groups, but they are losing, he insists. So much more to this story, but this is what it's all about. So we'll speak to you tomorrow and cover some other news and information. So I wish you all well. Thank you for being with us today, as always. And thanks to all our guests from Ron Matten, Michael Edelman, and John Bailey. And thanks to you for listening. All the best. Goodbye.